Hello, and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. In this episode, we're going to talk everything about protein, why we need it, how much we need, how much is optimal, and the quality of the different sources of protein. And I am delighted to be joined by Vasanto Molina, who's a sought-after speaker at health conferences worldwide. She's a consultant for individuals as well as the government of British Columbia. She's the lead author of the last position paper on vegetarian diets for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Also, Vasanto received the prestigious Riley Jeffs Memorial Award for Dietitians of Canada, where she resides. Her website is Nutraspeak.com. Vasanto, thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thank you, Sharon. It's a pleasure.
So protein is such a controversial topic. I'm not really sure how it got so controversial, but it feels like there's so many people in different camps of how much you need. Some people saying we don't get enough. Some people saying we get too much. And then, of course, a lot of conversation around what is good quality protein? Are we getting our amino acids? Just it seems like there's always talk about protein. So I'm so excited to have you kind of straighten all this out and help answer some of these questions. So if you don't mind, I'm going to start by asking you very basics, like why do we even need protein? What does protein do in our body?
Everybody always thinks of muscles, and that's true. But our bones are also made of protein. They're protein matrix and with minerals embedded in it. Little kids have pretty flexible bones because there's lots of protein and less minerals. And as we get older, our bones become more fragile because there's more minerals and less of that flexible protein. But still, we need protein for that. And also to protect us with our immune systems, there are communication proteins, there are transfer proteins, all kinds, and they're really long, complex molecules, convoluted and with certain shapes. And we need the exact set of amino acids for getting the protein just right.
Well, what happens if we don't get enough protein?
Well, I did research starting in the, 60s, long time ago. I was a student and then teaching university. And we were concerned about protein back then, something like called kwashiorkor in developing countries. Now, over time, you know, the little kids, they would actually have a white section in their hair because their body had decided to put what little protein they had into their heart muscles and their muscle, their heart and their muscle, but not to bother making their hair black. You know, at that time when it was really short, it was really interesting. The research then. But after a while, we realized they just weren't getting enough food. Like it was really a different situation, primarily. We don't find protein shortages in North America unless somebody's anorexic or something like that. Sometimes for a senior that isn't hardly eating very well, not eating much. So we don't really find that in any of the dietary groups. Like you could be a vegan and be short of protein if you ate pop and potato chips, which are vegan foods, but people don't do that. So the vegans tend to be eating quite well.
And if people don't, like let's say on a given day they had one meal with protein, but maybe not a lot of, but their dinner had mostly carbs and they didn't get the recommended amount for that day, does that adversely affect muscle? Or does that not something that a person needs to be very worried about?
We were thinking that you had to get protein through the day to get the amino acids, but we now find out that adults particularly can pool their amino acids in the body. So if they did only eat once a day, which isn't a very common practice or necessarily advisable, but they could get enough protein if they really boosted up that meal. They could get enough at one single meal, but you can pool it. So we don't worry so much. Sometimes with kids, little kids, we think, well, it's really good to spread it out a bit. I mean, from a scientific perspective. Of course, from a meals perspective, it's better to spread it out a bit too.
And when you spread it out versus eat it at one meal, do you absorb the protein better? You know, for example, with calcium and some other nutrients, there's a maximum amount we're going to absorb at any given time. How does that work with protein?
We don't seem to have those thresholds. Like with calcium, if you are having, say your recommended intake is 1,000 milligrams, it's better for you to take that at three different times of the day because your absorption mechanism gets maxed out and then you don't absorb the rest of it. So it's better. But with protein, you can just eat it and you absorb it well. There's lots of places for protein absorption in the intestine.
And let me take a step back. You know, we're jumping into, you know, whether people don't get enough, but let me start by asking, how much should people be getting?
Well, the recommended intakes are officially, across North America, 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of healthy body weight. So if somebody's way overweight, they don't have to feed all their fat cells with that much protein. And so it is based on healthy body weight. Now, that's in kilograms. So if you're plant-based, unless you're eating a lot of soy, which has an absorption pretty similar to meat, some of the beans and so on have a slightly less absorption in the grains, we suggest 0.9 grams of protein per kilogram healthy body weight. And that's for adults. At different age groups, there are slightly higher recommendations. You know, if somebody's going through pregnancy or for a child, they're slightly higher. Or if an athlete's adding muscle mass. So somebody who's just doing weekend running, this kind of thing, fitness, they don't need to increase beyond the what we would suggest is 0.9. Now that amount actually has a 25% safety margin. So it's more than most people need.
And that's an interesting point because I think this is where there's a lot of controversy that 0.8 in general or 0.9 for predominantly plant-based sources, that's the RDA, right? That's the recommended daily allowance for protein.
That's right.
And what does that value actually represent? Meaning that's the minimum requirement or optimal requirement?
Oh, no, that is actually meeting 97.5% of the population. So it's definitely got a safety margin in there. And our body's very wise. Like sometimes we economize on protein a bit.
And that's for 97 to 98%. So if a person got more, because this seems to come up a lot, whether people need to have more protein. Is there added health benefit to getting more than this amount?
Well, for some people, it is good to get more. For example, for seniors. And the European recommendations in many countries are slightly higher, somewhat higher for seniors, because our absorption drops as we get older. It doesn't drop necessarily for every single person, but on average, we suggest 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. So again, that's pretty easy to obtain, especially if somebody's on a whole foods plant-based diet.
Yeah, in a little bit, I'm going to come back to kind of how to get the protein. So as people are getting older, up to which age would you recommend people transition from 0.9 or 0.8, depending on the source of protein, to the 1 to 1.2?
Well, it's around what we'd consider seniors. So could be 50 in some places, 65 in others, according to recommendations. But I like to be slightly beyond the minimum, you know, the official RDA. And the official RDA is not different in North America for seniors, but it is in some European countries, which I think they're smart to do that. I hope we get there. To have slightly higher recommendations for seniors.
Yeah, absolutely. And exactly to the point you just made, that absorption and synthesis of muscle. I mean, I think certain things change over time. So
that's exactly right. Yeah, your mechanisms can slow down a bit. They can still be working well, but not quite as well.
Yes, like most things as we get older. You know, muscle mass is also very strongly correlated to longevity, right? So one of the most important things, certainly clinically, as indicators are like grip strength, for example, percent muscle mass. These are so tightly correlated with how people will age. So preserving muscle from middle age onward, not just when people are older, is so vital. For people who are weightlifting and trying to preserve muscle mass, so I'm thinking, let's say someone is middle age and trying to make sure that their senior years are well spent. If a person's actively weightlifting and trying to build muscle mass, how much protein should that person get?
Well, just regular people doing exercise, which they should be doing, you know, whether it's lifting your shovel full of dirt out in the garden or lifting weights, we do need to be using our muscles in order to maintain good muscle strength. So the fact you could take all the protein powders there were and you still wouldn't build muscle mass if you weren't using your muscles. So it's got to be a combination. I just finished a class with seniors, actually, just before this interview. And we do that even through COVID. We did it 3 times a week online. And I walk around the lake every morning with my husband and do yoga. And, you know, we do a mix of things. But you really do need to do some lifting, some muscle, use of muscles to keep them strong. And then it helps to eat some good protein foods, and especially that have leucine or the branched chain amino acids in them. And that really helps. As we get older, we avoid sarcopenia or muscle wasting, which happens to some seniors. Actually, I remember my aunt, she was 102 and she had a bath and she could not get out of the bathtub. And luckily, a neighbor, I mean, we went over and fixed it for her so that she had alternatives and could have showers and sit, but she could not get out of the bathtub. And it was a very scary experience for her. You know, you could just start losing muscle mass.
Absolutely. And I want to emphasize a point you just made, because I think it's so important. Just having more protein is not going to make a person more muscular. It's that.
No.
But, you know, these are questions that I think a lot of people have, because there's a perception that if you maintain your protein intake, you maintain muscle. But it's, so you just said, you have to couple that with strength. You have to use the protein, if you will.
That's right. Yeah. And our bones know too. You know, when we use that strength, we maintain our calcium and our muscle mass, or our bone mass as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain, I guess, threshold of amount of exercise where people do need more protein? So I know, of course, there are elite athletes who do more than, say, you and I would do for going to the gym and weight resistance. Are there certain populations in terms of athletics who need to do more protein because of their level of intensity of exercise?
People who are building muscle need more. But when people are maintaining, and everyday athletes don't need to do more than that 0.8 or 0.9 grams per kilo, or for seniors, the 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilo healthy body weight. By the way, if somebody's thin and smaller, they need to do it on the base of a slightly higher body weight. I've had some clients who were on the slight side and were trying to increase their muscle strength and their body mass. So they should be edging up there.
So what range of body mass index would that apply to?
If you're under 18, under 18.5, yeah, you should.
Okay, so underweight.
Yeah, underweight.
Yeah, that's very helpful. A question that I get asked a lot is timing a protein intake relative to the strength resistance exercise. Is there an optimal time of having your protein?
I think Brenda, ask Brenda that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll do.
She went into that one more.
Okay. Perfect. So let's talk about the source of protein. There's many ways to view what makes protein a quality source of protein. So how would you say is a good framework to approach how to evaluate protein?
This is kind of a funny story, but in the 50s, we wanted to evaluate protein. So to figure out how much, you know, how valuable it was, they would use weanling mice or rats. These little beings double their weight within 4 weeks. They're 4 weeks old, and then they double their weight. And they're growing fur all over. They grew really well on meat and cheese. So we got an idea that this was the best protein source. But people that I know don't want to double their weight, and they don't grow fur all over their body. So these, you know, perspectives were not entirely suitable. They were checked out on children a bit later, but again, it was children who were malnourished. So it wasn't exactly the same utilization. It's been an evolution. So we're still trying to figure out the best way to evaluate protein quality, because your bacteria in the gut kind of interfere with the whole process, and they use up some protein. So what they found now is if you look at the protein going in and then do a biopsy right at the edge of the intestine about how much was absorbed during the small intestine, then you can see how much protein was absorbed. But not that many people want that process, and it's just been done on very limited. But what we found in that is that plant and animal proteins are equivalent. However, countries, for example, Canada is still using the protein efficiency ratio assessment level. The United States has moved into the PDCAAS, protein digestibility corrected amino acid score assessment, but those all have real limitations because of how they were developed on animals or on little children that were malnourished. And so the whole situation, like, we're kind of struggling with how to assess protein. The research we have from these more evolved but very limited studies show that the protein from plant protein is working out just fine. So that's kind of the stage that we're in. We'll be keep looking at protein. Nutrition's a very young science, by the way. Like, the vitamins were discovered just over, vitamin A, for example, just over 100 years ago. And B12 was like 70 years ago. So it's pretty new. We're still finding things out.
That's a really good perspective and good history as a background. And when you mentioned that a lot of plant proteins work out, so there's absorption, as you mentioned, for example, that's one factor to, you know, in this whole, you know, people do a lot of compare contrast when it comes to different types of proteins. So the absorption is less than the meat and cheese diet, but just going up 0.1 kilograms or gram, I should say, per kilogram, that's adequate for the difference in absorption. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah. We suggest a varied diet, like a mixed diet. One other thing with those little rats is all they got to eat was one thing. Like, that is not any kind of diet for humans.
For a whole host of reasons, right.
Yeah. But from our whole diet, and we have on plant-powered protein website, we have a food guide that people can look at. And, you know, it's got a balance. It's got grains, and we get plenty of protein from grains. Half the world's protein actually comes from grains. It's got vegetables, and some of those are very high in protein. You know, they're low in calories, but when you eat significant amounts, there's protein coming from those. And nuts and seeds are good protein sources. And then the legumes are really the heavy hitters in the protein department. But we get it from a variety, and we absorb these pretty well. It works out. For some of them, it's equivalent to the absorption from animal products, and for some, it's a little bit less. So if we add that 10%, we're fine.
Let's talk a little bit more about the sources. And as you mentioned, I think a lot of people associate protein with a finite number of foods or food types, but fruits, vegetables, whole grains, like you said, all have protein. Can you talk more about how much protein do they have?
Okay, well, the one group that we really don't think of as protein sources is the food group is the fruits. So they just have typically under 10%, maybe even just 3%, 5% calories from protein. They're pretty low. The nuts and seeds can be much higher, up to like 30%, similar to cheese, calories from protein. And things like walnuts aren't really valuable for their protein. We want them for the omega-3s. So the seeds are particularly high in protein among the seeds and nuts. And the vegetables, there's quite a range, but leafy greens, surprisingly, have significant amounts of protein, like in the 30s, around 30%. And then the legumes are really particularly high. And notice that we think of meat and animal products as protein foods, but we could more likely be thinking of them as fat foods, because that's what they really deliver mostly. Many of them are over 50% calories from fat. No carbohydrates, of course, except a little bit in milk.
Right, and that's exactly what I was going to ask you, Vasanto. So to put this in the context of, say, if a person had chicken or meat, what percent of calories in meat come from protein?
Well, it is kind of a range, but it can go from about 40 to, in a few foods which are low fat, it could be in the high 80s% calories from protein. But mostly it's typically lower, maybe around 40%. And soy foods can deliver that easily. So they're very comparable, and the absorption, the protein, the amino acids delivered, all that are comparable, very similar.
And let me make sure I'm understanding. When we say as a protein as a percent of calories, green leafy vegetables, for example, are extremely low in calories. So when we're getting 30% protein from a very low calorie source, does that translate to fewer grams of protein? Is that the correct way to think about it?
That's right.
Okay.
I've worked with people who were on raw food diets, and they'd practically have a wheelbarrow full of salad, you know, in their total lunch and supper. And they would, I've worked it out carefully. And when they were eating enough of these raw vegetables and fruits and some nuts and seeds, you could get the protein up to the recommended intakes. So it's quite impressive with a few people. Yeah. But people can also be short when they're on raw fruitarian diets. That's where we found it, raw, short.
If you were to make a recommendation for what a daily meal plan would look in terms of what blend of protein from grains, blend of protein from the green leafy vegetables, legumes, I know this is obviously a big, long question, but is there a kind of rough rules of thumb around what a daily intake would look like?
For the different food groups, again, go to that plant-powered protein website, and there's a food guide there. So if you don't remember everything I say, you can just have a look at that. But what we have is basically half of your intake is vegetables and fruit, a little over half. And then there's a slice is the nuts and seeds. So we want at least like 4 servings of fruits and 5 of vegetables, more is fine. And then the nuts and seeds, 1 serving, and focus on those with omega-3s, like flax and walnuts and chia seeds, hemp seeds. Those are all good nuts and seeds to have. And then the grains are kind of optional. You can go easy on them if you're trying to lose weight. They deliver B vitamins, but so do the legumes. So you can back off on the carbohydrates, but that could be a quarter of your intake. And then the legumes, the beans, peas, lentils, those are things that grow in pods. And peanuts are in there too. So one of the things we suggest is to have legumes 3 times a day. Now, that doesn't mean you sit down to a big bowl of baked beans at breakfast, lunch, and supper. It can be pretty simple, like spreading peanut butter on your toast, which my husband does every single day, like just quick and simple. Or you could have soy milk on cereal, perhaps with some nuts and seeds and grains. And then for lunch, I suggest using one of the legumes or soy foods at lunch and at supper. But there's 20 different kinds of legumes. Can you think of how many? Maybe some of the listeners could think how many they know. Just how many different ones do you come up with when you think of that? And what are your favorites?
Well, there's so much variety. What I love about the kind of picture you're painting of what the daily intake is, I think a lot of times when people focus so much on, say, getting adequate protein, then the other things fall by the wayside, i.e. we still need fiber. We need to have the recommended amounts of fruits and vegetables. You know, there's obviously a lot of epidemiologic data on getting nuts and seeds and the impact on mortality and quality of life. And it just seems that to get all of this, there are only so many calories you can eat in a given day. But what I love is you're hitting all those targets. And yes, doing that still gives you the protein, as opposed to if you singularly focus on protein, sometimes you miss on looking at diet in a broader view of, am I meeting the recommended for really what we know helps people live longer and live healthier in terms of the adequate fruits and vegetables, et cetera, nuts and seeds. So is that a good way to think about it, to kind of not worry per se about protein, but just know that if we're getting this very well-rounded dietary intake, that we're going to be fine with protein? Or do we need to specifically work in extra protein in some way if we're thinking that maybe we need a little bit more?
Well, for a lot of people, it comes pretty easily. Like if you look at that pattern and just make sure you've got some fruits, some vegetables, some nuts and seeds, some grains perhaps, and some legumes, and it falls into place. For other people, it's a real challenge. I've had clients with food allergies that were down to just a few foods, and we could work it out. We could still work out foods. Or I had once in a senior center, a gentleman that would only eat four foods. And we figured out four that really worked for him. So, you know, there's all kinds of different things. And then I've trekked in Nepal, and our Sherpas that were doing all the work of carrying our packs, they lived on dal bhat and saag. That was rice and lentils and spinach. And I think they had chicken once a year as a big celebration. They were so strong, they were carrying all our packs. So people can manage in a lot of different ways. And sometimes it can really help, though, to round it out. Like legumes are some of the things I've found people struggling with. I've had people from a nursing home say, can you help our cook decide what I could have? Because I'm the only person here who's vegan, put on the menu. So we would figure out something that, you know, this poor overworked cook, he didn't want to overburden them, but you could figure out something simple they could use. Or it could be somebody whose shopping skills or their cooking skills are quite limited. So sometimes we have to figure out something that will fit. Other people have perhaps dental challenges. But with all of this, it can actually work out. You kind of, when you're shifting to more plant-based in this way, you need a few little things to learn, and then it's smooth sailing. Because most people eat about the same 10 recipes their whole for years and years. So you just got to find those few new ones that you actually like, can do easily, taste good, that kind of thing.
I want to ask you, with the time we have left, around supplements, a lot of people ask about adding, say, a protein powder to their smoothie, adding or supplementing to make sure they're getting the adequate amount. Is there a place for that? Should people be doing that?
When we were researching all this, we found that the branched-chain amino acids, and leucine particularly as an amino acid, could really help with building muscle mass. And for a few people, the protein powders could be a help. Now, they could do it just with soy foods, for example, but they could also do it with the protein powders. And the protein powders that were on sale everywhere have been whey, like a byproduct. It was thought of as a waste product from dairy industry. But we found that soy works just as well. And there's very good protein powders with like pea protein. The two groups who can benefit from that are those that are actively increasing their muscle, like a bodybuilding competition or something like that, or the seniors who just are not eating that well. They have sarcopenia and they're just, you're needing to get some protein into them. Their whole eating is rather limited for a while and they can start building back that muscle mass, and protein powders can help in that area. Mostly we sure don't need them.
Yeah. And the, you know, you mentioned the brand chain amino acids. So if you broke down the supplements that are out there, like you said, there's whey supplements, there's pea supplements.
So whey is, of course, a dairy product, but for the vegan ones, the soy turns out to be very good with the leucine, the branched chain amino acids, and pea protein is a good one too.
Is there a recommended amount? Like if someone's going to supplement, if they're actively trying to build muscle, is there a certain number of grams after a workout or any recommendation around that?
We put specific amounts for various situations in our Plant Powered Protein book, but I can't think of them just in my head right now. But it's not a lot. Like it's just an amount you can put into your smoothie, that kind of thing.
Yeah, like a scoop or whatever the
exactly,
you know, yeah, recommendations are around the label, and that's adequate.
That's right. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And is there any time when you feel people need anything other than plant-based sources? Sometimes people wonder if they need a piece of chicken or eggs or other sources of protein. Are there scenarios where you feel people may not get what they need through plant-based sources?
It seems not. No. We're finding not only is this valuable because you get all the amino acids you need, but you don't get a lot of the contaminants that you find in some of the animal products. And it's easier on the environment. That's one of the things that came up in our plant-powered protein book, is that when you choose a plant-based, whole food plant-based diet, it's way easier on the environment. And we have a good chapter on that that was helpful with Brenda Davis's son, Corey, wrote. He's a government environmentalist. So it was really exciting to learn that switching to the plant protein sources can not only keep you healthier, because you're missing a lot of these damaging components, TMAO, new 5G, the saturated fat levels that are so much higher, and less of the contaminants that are there, but you're also helping the environment. It was really exciting to see all these additional reasons for going plant-based, and people are doing it everywhere. I just did a workshop with, or a presentation in an area that was all farming, all kinds of farmers, pigs and chickens. And I thought there might be some negative feedback or something. Instead, people came by and said, well, actually, I've got diabetes, or my husband has heart disease, or my grandson's gone vegan. So they were interested, all these people. And I know things are shifting in the world. It's really heartwarming that people are taking advantage of this very positive step.
Speaking of that, Vasanta, is there anything we haven't had a chance to talk about that you think is important for listeners to know?
If they look at that food guide on the Plant Powered Protein website, they can see a little bit about vitamin B12, vitamin D, and look at the specific amounts, and iodine. So they're specific nutrients. So below, if you scroll down, you'll see the different amounts. But it isn't that hard to get your protein, and it's kind of a relief. We had fun doing that book because we thought it was going to be like ho-hum, it's easy to get your protein, but it turned out to be just fascinating. Our publisher asked us to do this book, and we were like, oh, you don't need to worry about protein on plant-based diets. But it turned out there was lots and lots of interesting material.
Oh, that's fantastic. And for people listening, the book is called Plant Powered Protein, Nutrition Essentials and Dietary Guidelines for All Ages. And it's already available. And you have the website as well. Do you want to tell people about resources to learn more and how to find you?
My website is nutraspeak.com. NutriSpeak.com. And my email address, if people wanted to do a consultation or something like that, is vesanto.melina@gmail.com. That's vesanto.melina@gmail.com. And you'll find on the Plant Powered Protein a lot of different resources too, or on both of those websites. And people can really have fun with this evolution to a new stage. It doesn't have to be hard.
Mm-hmm. And we'll attach those websites and those links to the show notes so people can find them there. So, Vesanto, thank you so much. I am looking at you, and we talked before this podcast that you're 81 years old, and I'm just marveling at this as I'm looking at you as we're having this conversation. You look fantastic. Obviously, you practice what you preach, and you're great proof that it works. People do really well. Thank you. And you know, this is your 14th book, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, our books are in 10 languages now, too.
Gosh, so thank you for the tremendous contribution that you make to us understanding nutrition and the nutrition world, and for all the work that you do.
Oh, well, I love doing it. I appreciate what people are doing all over the place, you know, helping their mom get a healthier diet or exposing their father-in-law who never thought he'd eat a plant-based burger to something new. And he goes, wow, this is not too bad. So anyway, people are just moving in this direction. And it's very heartwarming. Thank you, Sharon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.